everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This show is dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And as always, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to the show today. I want to remind everyone that if you haven't gone over to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, I invite you to do so. Just like me or friend me over there. I'm doing a whole series on how to thrive and survive during the holidays, so I have lots of great tips. And as always, I do offer lots of great information and insights and interviews and articles and strategies. So be sure to go over to that Facebook page and always check on the website. In fact, I suggest just opt in there, which is whatwomenmustknow.com, because that's a place to get free reports. You have access to many of my published articles. There are some good videos up there now. You will be receiving these archived radio shows every week. So if you don't get to listen live, you won't miss out on the great information and my fantastic guests that are doing such a great job in helping to expand our awareness and expand our consciousness. So it's What Women Must Know. Try out the website, go over to the Facebook page, and just keep learning and growing and expanding, because that's where the answers are, on the outer borders of our awareness. So that's why it's fun to keep on learning. And we're going to do lots of learning today. I have a wonderful program in store. My guest today is Dr. Lise Alschuler. She received her naturopathic degree from Bastyr University in 1994 and is board certified in naturopathic oncology. She is past president of the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians, was a founding board member of the Oncology Association of Naturopathic Physicians as well. She is the co-author of The Definitive Guide to Cancer, An Integrative Approach to Prevention, Treatment, and Healing, now in its third edition, and Five to Thrive, Your Cutting-Edge Cancer Prevention Plan. She, along with her co-author, Carolyn Gazella, have created the website, which is 5tothriveplan.com, a multimedia website dedicated to sharing information about integrative cancer prevention and treatment. They also co-host a daily radio show, 5 to Thrive Live, on www.w4cs.com, which provides listeners with tools for living healthier lives in the face of cancer. So as we all know, we are living in a society that is confronted by so many people who discover they have cancer episodes going on in their lives. And this is a great opportunity to help us find our way through this maze. So thank you for being here with us today, Dr. Lise Alschuler.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's a pleasure for me because you have such great knowledge, and I just love what you're doing in your books and trying to decipher this journey in a manner that people can understand what are the issues, the steps, the strategies they need to take to support them on this healing journey. You know, yeah. I've been, I just want to say, I'm sorry to cut you off, I just want to say one thing. I've been doing a lot of consulting with people lately. I actually am doing work with genomic testing, so I get a chance to look at people's genes that are potentially risk factors based on, you know, the number of categories for liver and detox and inflammation and methylation and all these key issues. And so many people I'm consulting with now are on this cancer journey. And I just hear so much confusion and uncertainty and dissatisfaction with the plan that the traditional model has laid out for them. And, you know, I just think this is a really timely conversation because this is it's so important to give people a plan and a strategy and knowledge to find their way through.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, and cancer is by nature a very disempowering disease. It's overwhelming. It's aggressive. It's scary. The treatments are overwhelming, aggressive, and scary. So people who have this diagnosis really enter into a world where they all of a sudden can, in many cases, feel very small And I think part of what my co-author Carolyn Gazella and I are trying to do in our work is to empower people to get a little bigger and to be able to step into the ring with a little more authority and negotiate through the rest of their life towards health, because I actually think that the experience of cancer can also be a gift, and it's a bit of an unpleasant one, but nonetheless it can be a gift because it can open up opportunities to discover, like you were mentioning, causes for disease and potential risk factors, as well as opportunities to gain more health. So in the end, I think it can be a very fulfilling experience, but it also has certainly a lot of difficulties. And unfortunately, so many people diagnosed with this disease are in a treatment situation that is not very good, and they don't feel very well as a result.
Exactly. I was thinking of how to frame our conversation today. I know you talk about the five pathways, how to transform your internal landscape with five pathways: immune, inflammation, hormones, insulin resistance, and digestion, detoxification. I think we really need to touch on all those areas because they're all critical pieces of this puzzle. But here's what I want to ask you to begin with. If someone discovers that they have cancer, they just have a diagnosis. So all of a sudden they're in shock because this is, has been thrust into their lives without any preparation or forbearing of any sort. What would you suggest to be the first step for people?
Well, and what you say is true 90% of the time. I think that when people are first diagnosed, they actually need to literally take a breath and sort of step back and settle themselves, get grounded in their own life, and take an account of what it is that they need to do, what information they need to gather to be able to take the next step with as much confidence as possible. And I said next step very specifically because one of the things that people can do when they get diagnosed is that they cruise through a million steps and their mind is already, years down the line, and it's very overwhelming and a lot of anxiety can occur. So I think one of the most important things is to just take the next step. And then once you've taken that, okay, now you're ready to take another breath, step back, see where you need to get more information, more support, whatever it is, and then take the next step. And just taking it a step at a time is really important, particularly because the disease and the treatments are both so powerful that how you feel and what's going on can change really dramatically from even day to day. So it's important to kind of stay present with things.
So if someone does get a diagnosis, there's this fear that now they have to immediately do something and they have to do it fast. And I think they get that encouragement from their oncologist or whoever they're seeing, that there's a sense of urgency that suddenly is in their life. Do you find that to be true? Do people have time to step back, learn a little bit, maybe get some second opinions, third opinions?
Yes. Yeah, and it's true that they are given that sense of urgency. There are very rare situations that that's true, but there are some situations where it really is a matter of weeks that people need to get into treatment, but those are rare cancers. The vast majority of people, when they're diagnosed, have time to get second opinions, to gather resources, to kind of lay the foundation that they'll need to be successful in their next phase. And, there's actually been some studies, for example, women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer who've had surgery and then are planned to get radiation therapy as a follow-up. Women who delay the radiation therapy by more than 5 months do have a worse result from, or it's not as effective for them as women who get it within the first 5 months after completing surgery. But that's a pretty big range, and that's just one example. But clearly there's time in most cases for people to at least gather their wits about them and, get the people that they need on board. And I think that, that includes second opinions, as you mentioned, because second opinions can really give people just that trust factor in their provider, which is really important to their ongoing wellness.
So do you see people as their primary practitioner they're working with, or do you work with oncologists? What's you know, what's the focus of your practice?
Mm-hmm. Most of my patients are under the care of an oncologist. Some patients have been through the treatment and they're seeing me as their as the provider that's helping them to reduce risk of recurrence, and they're seeing their oncologist for, you know, checkups, for scans and so forth. Some of my patients are in active oncology treatment, chemotherapy, radiation, et cetera, and they're seeing me to help them manage that treatment and get the most benefit from that treatment. There's a smaller minority of my practice of patients that are not candidates for conventional treatment for one reason or another, that are getting suggestions and recommendations from me. Some of my naturopathic colleagues, naturopathic oncology colleagues, tend to, their ratio is a little different, so they might see more of the patients that are not in active conventional care. Just so happens that my practice tends to be more of an integrative oncology practice, so most of my patients are actually have a team of providers. I happen to think that that's a great system because, as I often tell patients, it's not about using alternative medicine or conventional medicine. It's about using the best medicine that's going to help your body, you know, get rid of this cancer and live as healthily as possible. And that is usually a combination of tools across that spectrum.
You know, it's always a challenge to find the people that you really, number one, can trust, and number two, are in alignment with your way of dealing with things. You know, there's just so many times patients have to fit their belief systems into the model of their oncologist, even though it's not always comfortable. So I always see that as a challenge for so many people that I've been consulting with. It's like, where do you find the right team?
Yes, and that is a problem. It's, I think, fortunately, a problem which is shrinking slowly, but it is shrinking. More and more oncologists are open-minded to the fact that their patients are going to be using some additional therapies. And, you know, quite frankly, there's more integrative practitioners that are open-minded to the fact that their patients might benefit from conventional therapies. And I think that open-mindedness on the practitioner's parts across the aisle and all spectrums is important, because ultimately a closed-minded practitioner only harms the patient. And, you know, the patient, the last thing we need to do is triangulate patients so that they have to be negotiating between their providers. And I think it's really our duty as healers to offer the best that we can offer, but ultimately to support the patient's decisions. And finding that group of providers can, yes, as you say, be very difficult. And I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons why I encourage my patients to keep searching until they find the right providers. And, you know, we're all, I mean, they can fire us as easily as they can hire us. And in fact, if they fire, you know, so to speak, providers that are not providing what they want philosophically or actually, then that sends a message to the providers, and that hopefully will ultimately change the way healthcare is practiced so that in general it's more integrative.
So what does a naturopathic oncologist focus on?
A naturopathic oncologist is, we've gone through our naturopathic training and our license as a naturopathic doctor, and then to be a naturopathic oncologist, we have we've met certain criteria, which includes a minimum of 5 years in practice, focusing on the care of people diagnosed with cancer, or completion of a 2-year residency that's focused on oncology. And then we sit for a board certification exam, and once we pass that, we are board certified in naturopathic oncology. And really what that means is that we have a focus on treating people diagnosed with cancer in our practice. Most naturopathic oncologists, it's all of their practice or well over half of their practice. So it's an area that we're able to keep more up to date in, because it's a very complex, changing field. So we need to know the conventional therapies that are being offered and the new ones that are out there. We need to know, you know, keep up on the research on some of the natural therapies that are have been studied in conjunction with or separate from conventional treatments. And then, obviously, we just need to know what the issues are that people have who are diagnosed with this disease. So it's really just a focus area. And I think where we're also a little bit different is we don't ourselves offer chemotherapy or radiation, but we're very comfortable working with the conventional oncologists that do those therapies.
Okay, that's great, because I don't think most people know that there is a specialty within naturopathic medicine that's dealing with oncology.
Yeah, it's a bit new. I think we've been certifying naturopathic oncologists for almost 10 years now. I think we're in our ninth year. So, you know, in the greater scheme of things, it's relatively new, and there's not very many of us, but there's enough across the country that most people should be able to find someone, perhaps a little travel, but there's an organization called the ONC, A-N-P. ONC stands for Oncology, O-N-C, and then A-N-P stands for Association of Naturopathic Physicians.org. So ONCAMP.org has a directory of all of the naturopathic oncologists in the country, so your listeners could go to the website and try to find somebody close to them.
Great. I'm sure a lot of people will be looking for their people in their neighborhood. Let's talk about these five dynamics, these five pathways, because they are pretty fundamental to understanding not only how to support and heal the body, but also what might have been one of the major factors that have contributed to the body getting so out of balance that cancer has emerged.
Right.
Where would you like to start?
Well, you know, one of the things that we came up, Carolyn and I came up with these five pathways because, you know, we've read thousands of articles, and I'm sure you have as well, but, you know, when you read research, you start to see patterns. And in looking through the research, we started to see that there were clearly five key areas of influence. I often refer to them as the superhighways of influence in the body, that when these, the health or the functioning of these five pathways had the most dramatic and profound impact on the health of the body overall, and in our case in particularly, whether the body was going to be more prone to developing or letting cancer grow as opposed to being able to keep it in check. So we really looked at these five pathways and then further looked at the research and discovered what the most powerful ways that we can support the health of these five pathways, and that really is the foundation of our Five to Thrive plan. It's kind of an efficient way of creating health. And so, you know, the five pathways are all very both complex and also very simple at the same time, and I think that one of the things that I've found in talking to patients and people about these five pathways is that there's sort of an intuitive resonance with this. It's like people say, oh, yeah, that makes sense. I kind of suspected that. And then it's really a matter of, as they learn more and some of the intricacies of how these pathways actually do end up creating health or disease, they, with that sense of knowledge, become motivated to change some of their lifestyle habits in ways that will support the health of these key pathways.
And, you know, that's so important because I think when someone is thrust into an experience with cancer or any chronic illness without any previous experience or previous knowledge of these pathways, they often just feel like they've been victimized, right? And so all of a sudden this thing has just happened to them and it's like they got to get rid of it. And the journey that I see unfolding for so many people is delving into the root cause issues. This didn't happen out of the blue. Your body was in an environment that has allowed these imbalances to occur over many years, decades, maybe many decades. And as you begin to unravel this process, you begin to take greater charge of your health and healing, because sooner or later, if these issues are not addressed, they're going to pop up in some condition that will lead to chronic health problems.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I think that when I talk about, you know, many people are looking for sort of an ironclad prevention plan. If I do X, Y, and Z, then I won't get fill-in-the-blank disease, right? And, you know, that's not available. Nobody's figured that out to the best of my knowledge. But what I can say is that by employing a plan like this and addressing some of these underlying causes of disease, then two things happen. Number one, people feel better right away, typically. And number two, they're creating more health in their body so that even if they do develop cancer or another disease, which can still occur in a healthy person for a variety of reasons that, you know, I can speak about, but even if they do develop cancer, they're going to be healthier with that disease, and that is a huge thing, because being a healthy person with cancer is a lot different than being a sick person with cancer. When you're a healthy person with cancer, you're number one, you're going to be more responsive to the treatments. You're actually going to get more benefit from them. Number two, you're going to tolerate and recover from those treatments more quickly. And number three, your risk for recurrence is going to be less. So just establishing greater health makes a huge difference whether or not you get disease. But of course, a lot of these strategies, you know, the purpose of these strategies is to lower your risk of disease. It's just not going to ever lower it to 100% to 0%, but it might lower it from, you know, 80% risk down to 20% or something like that.
Okay, well, let's start with the immune system, and we'll work through all of these five pathways today.
Okay, well, the immune system is, you know, oftentimes when people come in, they'll say, gosh, I have cancer, I'm sure, because I have a weak immune system. That's a very common thing that I hear. And, you know, that's sort of true, but sort of not true. It's actually possible to have a fairly strong immune system and still develop cancer. So this gets, the reason for this is because the immune system is like a well-choreographed dance, and there's very precise and very fluid actions, and all of these actions kind of work together to create the dance. And depending on which dancers are strong and which dancers are weak and who's doing the pirouettes and who's doing the leaps will determine the overall dance. And what we know about our immune system is that there are certain cell types which tend to be a little underactive in people who develop cancer. And so that there may be parts of their immune system that are fine, but there are other parts that are not so fine. And the not so fine parts tend to be what we call cytotoxic immune cells, or T cells, and also cells that are in part of our immune system called the innate immune system, and these are natural killer cells. And these T cells and these natural killer cells are like the, to use the army analogy, they're like the elite forces, the sentries that, you know, go out into the bush with their night vision goggles and find the enemy cancer cell lurking in the bushes and kill it on contact. They're very efficient killing cells. They're very good at surveying the environment and making sure that what isn't there is not there. And so part of the strategy for immune functioning is to increase the activity, the number and the activity of these T cells and these natural killer cells. And there's lots of strategies that we talk about in our plan to do that, but just to give an example that's kind of a fun one, you know, of course strategies are both include diet strategies, include exercise strategies, it includes dietary supplement strategies, and lifestyle strategies. So in the case of natural killer cells, we know that just the act of laughing and the feeling of joy, if somebody were to laugh, to get a good belly laugh, and find something really genuinely funny, there will be at least 27 different genes that will be activated inside their natural killer cells, the net effect of which will be to increase the activity of their natural killer cells for at least 4 hours after they have that good belly laugh, funny experience. So even something like joy can improve day-to-day natural killer cell function, which is a very significant part of our defense against cancer.
Well, you know, that's such an easy thing to do. You can just get out a good movie, a good comedy. You could be doing a lot to strengthen your immune system right there.
Absolutely. And, yeah, so that's an immune system. Another system we talk about, another pathway of influence, is the inflammation pathway. And when we talk about inflammation, we're really talking about chronic kind of underlying inflammation. I often refer to it as the embers of inflammation that are just, you know, there, hot, and are ready to catch on fire at any moment. And many of us live life as we get older. We become more and more chronically inflamed, and this is because we live in an oxidative world. There's chemicals that we're exposed to. There's stresses that we're exposed to that are highly that are highly inflammatory. They're highly oxidative. They damage our cells in a way that creates this ongoing kind of inflammatory reaction in our body. Some of us eat foods that are inflammatory by nature, or that we, because of our own genetics, don't handle very well. Even chronic just emotional stress can lead to these inflammatory reactions. So whenever we're under kind of chronic exposure that ultimately leads to chronic inflammation, our, the milieu of our body changes, and we start, our tissues start to experience levels of inflammatory compounds, things that are secreted by cells that are inflamed, in levels that they don't normally see for such a long period of time. And these inflammatory messenger molecules, these cytokines and interleukins and various hormones, change the way cells behave. Unfortunately, many of these little molecules tend to tell cells to divide faster. So people who are chronically inflamed tend to have cells that divide faster, and they don't have as much regulation. Cell is damaged besides, then that now fast-growing cell is going to be really, you know, at high risk for cancer. So inflammation is a really important thing to address.
You know, it really is an important factor, and it's one of those words that I think most people don't, like, they say it, but they don't really understand what it means or what it's really doing. So, you know, it's interesting, your comment, that actually when tissues are inflamed, they are putting the body at risk of, you know, faster cell growth and turnover. Can you just explain a little bit more? When someone is dealing with inflammation, is it always obvious? You know, the classic way of knowing we're inflamed is having aches and pains in your joints, for instance, like arthritis. Are there other symptoms, or is it often a subclinical condition going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question, and I think that it's both. I think that there, I actually think a lot of us as adults don't have any idea about what it means to feel truly well, because we've gotten so used to our chronic kind of subtle unwellness. Like, for example, it may be that somebody as an adult doesn't realize that being kind of groggy in the afternoons and, you know, irritable by the time Friday rolls around or having circles under your eyes, maybe that's actually not normal, and that's not a sign of having good health. I mean, I think a lot of us just don't really know what it means to be healthy anymore, so as a result, those subclinical symptoms of inflammation are actually apparent. People just aren't recognizing them, and I'm sure you see this too in your work, but as people become healthier, they start to recognize and to experience wellness in a way that they had no idea was possible. So in terms of inflammation, you know, generally speaking, it, you know, at its worst, it can be quite serious illness, and backing off of that end of the continuum can include anything from, as you mentioned, joint pains. It can be, people who are chronically inflamed tend to be tired. They may not sleep very well, often have depression or anxiety. They may have a tendency towards developing allergies or food sensitivities, common colds or flus, you know, more frequently than would be kind of expected. And then sometimes it doesn't really show up even in that way, and yet we can still find it if we do certain blood tests. There's certain biomarkers that will help us to see if the tissues are sending out signals of distress. And we can measure those and sort of look for the subclinical effects of inflammation.
Well, that's great information, and we're going to take a little break, Lee, so hang in there, because we have lots more to share, so much great information. And for everyone listening, be sure to stay tuned. This is Dr. Cheryl Stelman. You are listening to What Women Must Know, and we will be right back. Hello and welcome back to What Women Must Know. This is Dr. Cheryl Stelman. I'm so glad you're joining me today, because we are having such an important conversation with Dr. Lise Altshuler, who, with her co-author Carolyn Gazella, wrote a fantastic book called Five to Thrive, Your Cutting-Edge Cancer Prevention Plan. And it's a great book because it covers such key areas that are absolutely necessary if we're healing from cancer or we want to strengthen our body and have optimal health. But it also is written in a way that's really easy to understand, and that's always important. So, you know, if we have an easy read, we can grasp what's being said. So congratulations, Lisa. I think it's a great book, and
you cover
so many critical areas. Before we move away from the second pathway that we've been talking about, the first one was the immune system, and now we're talking about inflammation. What would be your recommendation as to the best foods or supplements to, you know, support that dampening of those flames of those embers of inflammation in the body?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are many, which is the good news. There are lots of ways to reduce inflammation. I think that some of the things that we talk a lot about in terms of inflammation is reducing the oxidative stress on the body, which requires antioxidants, and we can get a lot of antioxidants through our diet, and this is one of the reasons why we often will say color kills cancer, and what we mean by that is eating a diet that is colorful, that has a lot of colorful fruits and vegetables particularly, will have naturally in them lots of thousands of compounds that have natural antioxidant effects. And the advantage of eating these foods is that they're in low levels in the food, but there are lots of them. And cumulatively, they actually can have a very profound influence on the oxidative stress on a body. You know, just as an example, there was a researcher that measured various markers of oxidative stress by these blood biomarkers I mentioned earlier. So he had some individuals that had chronic inflammation as evidenced by these elevated markers in their blood. And then he did an experiment where these individuals ate a meal without color, so it was basically just kind of a white plate, as I say, so, you know, white rice and maybe some chicken or something like that, and he measured their blood levels of markers, and they actually got a little worse, and then all he did was add one cup of either blueberries in one group, or he did it again, one cup of broccoli, and in both cases, after eating that meal, the biomarkers went down. So even just, you know, something as simple as that illustrates the power of diet to reduce these inflammatory markers. And, of course, diet, all as good as it is, sometimes isn't quite enough. And I do believe that there's a role for dietary supplementation as well. And particularly with antioxidation, you know, one of my very favorite dietary supplements in this regard is glutathione, which is the body's most prevalent antioxidant. In fact, most of the other compounds that we think of as antioxidants, things like vitamin C and vitamin E, are used primarily to regenerate our body's glutathione levels. And there's kind of a pervasive myth that we can't absorb glutathione if we take it orally, but that's actually not the case. And taking a supplement of glutathione can be quite helpful to increase our body's production of glutathione. So I'm a big fan of glutathione, and I think that, you know, there are just in general some, you know, it's good to just get a good blend of antioxidants to support that glutathione. So, you know, even taking something as simple as vitamin C on a regular basis can be helpful and relatively inexpensive, as can vitamin E, particularly as mixed tocopherols and tocotrienols, which is the whole vitamin E complex.
You know, it's interesting you talk about glutathione in the nutritional genomic testing that I'm doing. What I've learned is that up to 60% of Caucasians have deleted glutathione genes. So it's mm-hmm. not only an issue that our genes may not be getting the right instructions, but it's the fact that they're absent. And that's amazing if you have 60% of Caucasians that are at risk of having one or more glutathione genes deleted, which really compromises our body's ability to make glutathione.
Right, yeah.
You find that?
Yes, and I think that's true, and that's particularly worrisome when we think about the highly oxidative world in which we live. So our demand on glutathione is very high, and if we don't make enough to meet that demand, we clearly need to supplement it. You know, you can get good glutathione through eating fresh, unprocessed foods. That's one of the reasons why eating a whole foods diet is so important. So fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, even actually fresh meats, have pretty good quantities of glutathione. Nuts, and particularly things like Brazil nuts, contain some of the precursors that your body uses to make glutathione. So there's ways to get glutathione increased through your diet. But I just think, given the stress of the oxidative stress of this world, supplementing is probably a really good idea. I mean, I take my Cetria glutathione every morning because I just, you know, feel like it's giving me a little extra insurance.
Yep, so do I. And I just recently had a test done, a micronutrient test done, to look at the level of the nutrients in my white blood cells, and one of the highest readings in that test was glutathione. So that was
All right, good report. For you.
Yes, I felt very good. Okay, so let's move on to hormones and the role of hormones in helping us to transform our internal landscape.
Yeah, hormones are interesting. You know, most people, when we talk about hormones, they immediately go to estrogen, and I'm sure that many of your women listeners will think the same thing. And that it is true that estrogen is a problematic hormone. It's something we rely on and we need for lots of good things, but it also is very cancer-causing in many women. And that has to do with the amount that women produce. It has to do with how that estrogen is broken down in the body. So estrogen can be a problem. But when we talk about hormonal balance, what we spend most of our time talking about are stress hormones. And so when people are under particularly ongoing chronic stress, it doesn't even have to be that severe. It can just be every morning driving to work and dealing with traffic and getting frustrated and angry and having a little car rage. It can be being under deadline and feeling, you know, like you just can't catch up at work. It can be just coming home to a busy household and having to manage everybody's meals and clothes and whatever. All those things take their toll. And the body, in part, responds to those events by activating an axis in our body called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is the primary glands that respond to stress. And when that system gets activated, there are certain stress hormones that get produced. Now, normally those stress hormones are produced in big spurts, in an acute, they're meant to be seen by the body for short periods of time. Like if there was a big, huge tiger in the back of the room, people would get really scared, their eyes would dilate, their muscles would get primed, and they would run. That's all the effect of these stress hormones. But if the stress is more like I talked about earlier, this kind of everyday, ongoing stress, these hormones are secreted, maybe not in the same level, but they're secreted more than they should be every day. And so the tissues of our body start to experience these stress hormones in their milieu on an ongoing basis. And they don't just sit there in the tissues. They're actually biologically active. And many of these hormones will bind to receptors on cells and will actually trigger processes in the cells that turn on cell division signals, that turn on the growth of blood vessels, which is something, if you have a little group of malignant cells, the last thing you want to do is give them a blood supply. These stress hormones turn on signals that help cancerous cells invade through the tissue and spread. So stress actually can perpetuate the growth of cancer, which is kind of scary, but also makes it very important for people to find stress management strategies that work for them and to start to interrupt some of that stress axis activation. And that can be done, you know, in day-to-day strategies that can range from playing, from exercising, meditating, praying, whatever it is that works for somebody, and may also include some supplementation there's some herbal therapies particularly that are very good at helping to rebalance that adrenal stress hormone. So there's a multifaceted way to support and to that stress system and to de-stress it.
I don't think most people appreciate just how devastating stress, especially long-term stress, can be on all these pathways that we've been talking about. And that could be, physiological stress if you're dealing with a chronic infection, or, I know the teeth often show up with chronic infections, with cavitations or root canals that don't really clear out the infections, or it could be the emotional stressors that we've been living with sometimes since childhood. And we're just so used to them, or we're unaware of them, that we don't pay attention to what they're really doing and the havoc they're wreaking in our bodies.
Right, and you bring up a good point that stress can be both physiological, as you mentioned, and psychological, and both kind of end up creating the same imbalances in the body. And you're absolutely right, too, that stress, I've given a presentation, and the title of the presentation is along the lines of stress unraveling the garment of life, and it is like that. It's very insidious and persistent, and before you know it, things are in quite a state of disarray. So, you know, it's very, very important for people to prioritize stress management.
Is this where you would put, if you're looking at those five pathways, would you put the need to address unresolved emotional wounds in that category?
You know, probably if those, because I would assume that, by using the word wounds, that it's causing some degree of stress to somebody's system. And,
right.
And that can be kind of subtle. Like, I think some people who have unresolved wounds don't feel like they're living life quite as themselves. And that creates a dissonance, which is quite stressful. And it's insidious and it's subtle, but it's there nonetheless. So I think addressing, you know, really deep and old psychological issues, as well as, you know, the ongoing day-to-day stresses are important.
Okay, let's, because I want to be sure we cover everything, and we're running out of time, or at least it's being used very, we're so engaged in this conversation, it's going rapidly. What about insulin resistance?
So insulin resistance is a pathway that unfortunately is becoming more common in people. If you just look around at the profile of most adults walking around, you'll see most of us have extra weight. And there's a lot of pot bellies, beer bellies, whatever you want to call them, and a lot of extra weight in women on the hips. And that's a kind of a good sign that there's a process going on called insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is considered a pre-diabetic state. It may or may not progress to diabetes, but even on its own, it's very disruptive and particularly problematic from a cancer perspective. So when people are insulin resistant, it means that their insulin receptors, which are basically receptors that bind to a hormone called insulin. Insulin is produced by the pancreas, and insulin is a chaperone for blood sugar. So when you eat food and it is broken down into blood sugar, which we call glucose, it's circulated in the blood, and it needs to bind to insulin in order to be taken in or chaperoned into the cell. And if you have too much of that blood sugar, or actually if you have other influences that directly damage that insulin receptor, which can be environmental toxins, it can be certain nutrient deficiencies like magnesium deficiency or B6 deficiency, a variety of things can interfere with the receptor's ability to bind to that insulin, which means you're not getting the blood sugar into the cells where your cell needs it to make energy. And instead, you have a lot of extra blood sugar and, in fact, extra insulin circulating in your blood. And when that happens, if you have a cancer cell sitting there, cancer cells are very bad at making energy. They need a lot of sugar to do it. And so they have a lot of insulin receptors on their surface. So even if the rest of your body is somewhat what we call insulin resistant, the insulin receptor is not working very well, even if some of that's true for the cancer cell, there's always plenty of insulin receptors on a cancer cell that are working just fine. So all that extra blood sugar and extra insulin will preferentially bind to the cancer cells. So now your sugar is feeding the cancer cell more readily, and the insulin, which is probably of the two even more problematic, the insulin acts as a direct growth factor to cancer cells, so it tells that cancer cell to divide. So insulin resistance is a very, very serious underlying condition which can fuel cancer growth, and it really needs to be addressed. Fortunately, there's a lot of strategies that we can employ to reduce insulin resistance. Clearly, at some point, weight loss is going to be an important part of that strategy. But before we even get there, just getting exercise every day, getting enough sleep. People who don't get enough sleep become insulin resistant. And conversely, people who get enough sleep, which is usually for women at least 7 to 8 hours a night, will lower their insulin resistance. So sleep, exercise, eating a diet of whole, unprocessed, unrefined foods with sufficient protein is very important. And then there are, again, some dietary supplements that can be quite useful, like magnesium, like fish oil and things like that.
And that's a big story, this insulin resistance, because it has such a direct effect on proliferating cells that thrive on sugar, but also because we have such a problem with people who are overweight and obese, which is, you know, I mean, in the research I've done, people who are overweight or obese are major candidates for creating chronic illnesses like cancer. There's a, you know, more and more of a correlation between cancer risk and being overweight.
Right. In fact, obesity is now considered responsible on its own for one out of every six deaths from cancer. So it's a risk for not only developing cancer, but from dying from cancer. It's very problematic. Our rate of obesity is alarmingly high, and it's not really just a matter of people lacking willpower. Obesity is a complex metabolic condition, and it's the result of eating the wrong foods. It's a result of being in an environmentally challenging world, so having environmental toxicity. It's the result of, like I said, not getting enough sleep. I mean, there's a multitude of factors that together create both obesity and insulin resistance. And I think that's important to say, because people who might have extra weight might be listening to this and think, okay, all I have to do is lose weight, but gosh, I keep trying and I can't do it. And it's not just a matter of reducing calories, although that can be and usually is an important part. There are other issues that need to be addressed to be successful.
So it's really about getting healthy again and understanding that it's really hard to be healthy if you're overweight.
It's about getting healthy, and it's about building in more resistance to the toxicity of our environment, which actually, if I may, leads me to my last pathway, which is about digestion and detoxification. You know, part of the reason we emphasize this pathway so much is because the toxicity of our world is, again, quite serious, and there's not only heavy metals that we're exposed to and accumulate, but there's various organic pollutants now that are in most everybody's tissues to more or less of a degree. And, you know, there's just the daily ravages of oxidative stresses. And so all of these toxic exposures, one of the things we can do is to detoxify them. And we have, fortunately, processes that are in place in our body, detoxification processes that we need to make sure are active as fully and as healthfully as possible. And so that's an important part of our defense, because if we don't detoxify the environment that we live in and the effect of that environment on ourselves, then we leave ourselves prone to those toxins, many of which are cancer-causing.
Well, you know, this is such a good point. I want to go back to this nutritional genomic testing, because it's taught me so much. And when I look at all the people that I've been consulting with, I haven't found anyone that has in their phase one, phase two panel, which looks at how well they can detoxify their environment, their toxins, that have strong genes to do that. No one. So it's almost like we've created a world, a toxic world, that our genetics has never learned, or we've inherited genes that have been impaired for whatever reason, and we cannot really thrive in this toxic world without support.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think most of us do need some detoxification support. And, you know, fortunately, a lot of the strategies that support one pathway also support another. So as it turns out, if we manage our insulin, we support our detoxification system. If we get enough sleep, our detoxification works better. If we take glutathione, our detoxification works better. So there are ways that we can support detoxification that we've already discussed. And there are even more targeted, you know, particularly nutritional supplements, which are really good at supporting in an ongoing way our detoxification systems, and ways that we can try to get more of the toxic exposure that we have reduced. So there's certain choices we can make in life that will reduce our exposure. For example, eating organically grown food and organic food from animals that, that have been organically fed. That is one very clear way to reduce exposure to toxic compounds. Trying to avoid buying products that are new and that outgas chemicals is another good way to avoid toxic exposure. So there's some definite strategies that we can put into place to help us along the path.
What's your favorite supplement that people could use to just give overall detoxification support? Would it be something like milk thistle?
I do like milk thistle a lot. I like milk thistle because it protects the liver itself, which is where a lot of this detoxification happens, and it also supports the detoxification pathways that are occurring, and it helps to keep bile flowing, and bile is where once the liver has detoxified compounds and is ready to get rid of them, those compounds are kind of bound up and put into bile, which is then transported to the gallbladder, stored, and then eventually ejected into the intestines to be incorporated into the bowel movement. So the better our bile is flowing, the better we're able to eliminate toxins. So I think milk thistle is a fantastic herb for that.
Great. Well, I want to be sure we give our listeners your website, and I know you have a radio show. Can I find the radio show by going to your website as well?
They can, yes. The website is 5tothriveplan, that's all spelled out, .com. My own website is drlise.net, which is drlise.net. And, yes, the radio. We have a page on our website, 5tothriveplan, that has information about the radio show.
Oh, this is wonderful because, you know, you have such a great knack of keeping it simple for people who don't have a lot of experience with medical terminology and physiology.
Yeah.
We need to keep it simple, you know, as we don't want people to just get so overwhelmed. So you're doing a great job, Lise. We only have a minute or two. Is there anything else you want to mention or touch upon before we have to finish our show today?
Well, you know, I really appreciate you having me on to talk about this. I know this is an area that I focus a lot on, and I feel, you know, there's a lot of potential for people to lead a healthier life in the face of cancer, or even if they haven't been affected by cancer, but they're, you know, have someone they know has been affected and they want to try to create a different course. And I guess I would just say that, you know, although this can invoke a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety, I think that through this illness, there's the potential to achieve such a tremendous health, well-being, and appreciation for the life that we live. So I really encourage people to really face their health situations full on and, you know, take it one step at a time and create change that is sustainable and that makes a difference to how they feel.
I always tell people, now's the time to learn. When you get a diagnosis and you're in a state of panic and crisis, it's not the best time to try to be learning what you need to know to help navigate through this process you're in. So having the chance to learn and investigate and keep your mind open and make the changes really is the most empowering thing people can do at any stage of life with whatever's going on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, Lise, thank you so much. I so appreciate your work, and I encourage everybody to pick up a copy of Dr. Lise Alschuler's book, 5 to Thrive, Your Cutting-Edge Cancer Prevention Plan. And the website, again, is 5tothriveplan.com. And Lise, thank you so much for sharing some time with us today and for the great work you're doing.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, and hope you have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you. Best wishes to you as well. And best wishes to all my listeners now that we're coming up with the holiday season, which is a great time for family and friends. But remember, it's also a time when we can get tempted into all of the foods and drinks and imbibing and beverages we don't normally do. So go to my Facebook page and learn about some of the tips to stay healthy during the holiday season. And I want to thank you all for joining me today. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and you've been listening to What Women Must Know. And today's guest was Dr. Lise Alschuler, who is the author of 5 to Thrive, Your Cutting-Edge Cancer Prevention Plan. And until next week, remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.